in the next week and a half. We'll do some particle physics. And the course will be taught by Natalia in the next, after you suffer from me for a week and a half, you'll have Natalia to teach you. So what are we gonna do in the next week and a half? The idea is to give you some reasons for and some physics for what are the kind of things we're looking for at large colliders. So the largest collider today on Earth is the Large Hadron Collider. And what we'll do in the next week and a half is to try to understand what are some of the reasons we're building such machines, what is the kind of physics we can expect to see in those large machines. And I hope that we can actually get to a point where we can calculate some of the processes that can be seen in those machines, okay? So the first part in the next few lectures will be more theoretical, if you like, more just the formal reasons why we consider those things. And then maybe next week, we'll do some actual calculations of processes, all right? But if I'm saying something that you're not familiar with, if I'm using some structure that you haven't seen before, just stop me and just raise your hand and say, we've never seen this before. Because I don't entirely know exactly what you have seen. Sounds good? All righty. So we'll start by, we're not gonna derive all the huge structures that people are considering, whether it's supersymmetry or other theories, but instead what I'll do, we'll start with a very simple theory, and we'll see all those different things that come out in those big theories appearing already in some very simple theory, okay? And you know that in quantum field theory, the way you describe what you're talking about is through Lagrangians, right? So you write all the field content, all the kind of interactions you have through Lagrangians. And so that's what we'll do. We'll write a certain Lagrangian, and the kind of field that we will discuss is just two kind of fields. One of them will be just a complex scalar field that I'll denote by phi. And it's a space-time field, so it's a function of x, right? And the other kind of field that we'll discuss is what's called a Weyl fermion. And I'll denote it by psi of x. And just to remind you that this is a fermion, it usually comes with a little index, which I'll write as alpha. It's a space-time index, right? And it's telling us that how that object transforms, all right? So this is sometimes also called Majorana. The distinction is usually just that if it's massless, we call it Weyl. If it's massive, we call it Majorana. And if there is another fermion that it couples to, then sometimes it's called Dirac. But we'll see some of it more in detail. Okay, so these are the two fields that we'll discuss. Are we all okay with that? Yeah. Okay, so let's start by writing what is the Lagrangian. I remind you that in quantum field theory, what you want to calculate are things like the path integral over all the different kind of field configurations. And so psi d phi, d psi, and you also have that over the conjugates, right? They also have this over the field conjugates, et cetera. By the way, I should say, when you take the conjugate of that, it's usually customary to then include a dot on the alpha, okay?
Yeah. So by conjugate, you mean taking the dagger and multiplying from the right side down to
two? No, so that's a good point. So when we're talking about, you have probably seen Dirac fermions. When you have Dirac fermions, then you usually what you do is that you have psi, and when you talk about psi bar is, as Tibro said, it's psi conjugate times some gamma naught, which is the Dirac matrix, right? So this is what you do for Dirac fermions. Dirac fermions are 4 by 1 vectors, right? They are something that has four components. Weyl fermions are not like that. Weyl fermions are 2 by 1 components. Okay, And what I mean by psi bar, I literally mean just, if you don't like that notation, just put a dagger here. There is no, you don't multiply it by any gamma zero. Okay? So the kind of things we calculate are, you do the path integral over e to the I action, right? Where the action is a function of those fields, if you like. But it's a function of something else as well. And that is the whole idea of effective field theory, is that the theory is not just defined in terms of its field content, but is defined also with respect to some scale, okay? That we usually denote as, if you like, lambda or lambda inverse, if you want to talk about length scale, if you want to talk about length scale, let's define it as lambda inverse. And this lambda is just some sort of a high energy cutoff. So high energy or high momentum cutoff. And what we mean by that is that if you think about, we're all human beings, so we like to think about length scales, right? So this theory is only defined up to length scales which are as small as inverse lambda. Okay, below those length scales, there are some other theories that has to replace this description and has to give the full description of this theory. Okay, or in other words, if I consider processes which are more energetic than this cutoff, I should no longer discuss this theory. I should discuss some other theory. Okay, so this is the idea of effective field theory, and this is how we will make sense of some of the infinities and some of the divergences we'll encounter. Okay, so it's important to keep in mind that quantum field theories are defined, most quantum field theories are defined with some sort of cutoff in mind. Okay, so have you seen these discussions before? Okay, so we'll see how that comes about very concretely in a few minutes. All right, so now the question is, what is S, right? So what is this action? So we know that in general, the action is the integral over the space-time. And I'm going to denote by the number of space-time dimensions as capital D. For pretty much all of what we need, D, capital D is equal to 4. But we'll see that so for all the kind of process we'll need, is D is equal to 4. But for some of the formal ways of defining the theory, we might have to deviate away from D equal to 4. Okay? But for our purposes, D equal to 4. Times some Lagrangian density. And this Lagrangian density is, of course, again, a function of the fields and the cutoff, right? Implicitly a function of the cutoff. And so what is that? What is that Lagrangian? The Lagrangian that I'm going to consider, let's write it here, okay? So the Lagrangian we're going to consider, at least at first, what do Lagrangians have? What kind of structures usually Lagrangians contain? Okay, so kinetic term for the fields, right? So we need to, just if you're ever confused about field theory, just think about what you know from classical mechanics, right? Or quantum mechanics. Lagrangians contain kinetic terms and some potential terms. So the kinetic terms are, you know, from classical mechanics, it's something like a derivative with respect to time of whatever objects that you have, right? And because it's complex, we'll place a little star on it, right? That's usually what kinetic terms are. But because it's relativistically invariant, we want a relativistically invariant theory. It shouldn't just be with respect to time. There should be some other terms here that has to do with differentiation with respect to space, right? And then we write something like nabla dotted into phi, right? And that makes it relativistically invariant. And throughout here, I'm setting, so for those of you who just came from condensed matter or something, in this course, speed of light is equal to 1, h-bar is equal to 1, okay? And so really, there should be a 1 over c squared in front of this term, but we don't see it, right? Okay, so that is as far as the kinetic term for the scalar is concerned, but what about the kinetic term for the fermion? We can also write that, and it looks something like psi dagger, and we have an index alpha dot. And the structures that, the only structure that we can have, well, so let's try to write. We know that fermions only come with one derivative, right? So we place some derivative on the fermion, right? And so there is some alpha here. By the way, so this whole entire structure is, of course, can be written as a single term, d mu phi star d mu phi, right? And I'm using the convention where the metric is the mostly negative metric. Okay. And the Einstein summation convention, which means that when I have two indices like that repeated, I should really be summing over the indices. Okay? So I want to write something like that for the fermion, and here is how here are the different terms that I have. I know that I need to have the conjugate of the field. I know I need to have the field itself, and I need to have some derivative because I'm writing a kinetic term. But I see that those different indices don't contract, right? So this is not relativistically invariant. So what is the kind of objects that you can use to contract them? Well, it's something that's related to the gamma matrices. Those are known as the Pauli matrices, right? And that term is sigma mu by mu alpha dot alpha dot alpha. Okay, so if you have never seen this term before, so how many of you have seen sigmas before instead of gammas? Okay, so for those of you who have never seen this before, it's a very simple object. So what we mean, did I put a bar on it? I didn't put a bar. I should put a bar. We'll see in a moment what it is. So what is that object? What is sigma? So sigma, you all know the Pauli matrices, right? So sigma 1 is equal to 0, 1, 1, 0, right? Sigma 2 is equal to 0 minus I, 0. Right? And sigma 3 is equal to 1 minus 1, 0, 0. Right? Those are the usual Pauli matrices. Now, we know that in relativity, I cannot just, so normally we just take them and we form a 3 vector. The 3 vector is sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. Right? But we know in relativity that this cannot be the full story because there has to be some sort of a time component to any kind of spatial vector. Right, we need to introduce some time component. And the time component is what other kind of matrix you can serve as a time component. We need a 2x2 matrix. What other kind of 2x2 matrix you have? Yes. Identity matrix. Perfect. And indeed that's what we'll need, because only the identity matrix will be linearly independent from the ones that I already wrote. You can convince yourself that any other matrix you try to write is not linearly independent, right? So indeed, we introduce what's known as the sigma naught, and that's just the identity matrix, right? And that allows us to construct a new object, which instead of being a 3 vector, is a 4 vector, which I'll denote as sigma mu, and it's just the identity or sigma naught and the 3 vector sigma vector. Okay? So these are known as the Pauli matrices, for the relativistic Pauli matrices. And the only kind of I wrote a sigma bar, not a sigma. And the reason is because there is another way of defining it, which has a minus sign in front of the spatial part. Okay, because you cannot get this from that, right? Those are independent of each other. All right. Now, how many of you have seen the Dirac matrices? Okay. So how do those relate to the Dirac matrices? All right. So let's just very briefly see how those matrices relate to the Dirac matrices. So obviously, the Dirac matrices cannot just be combination of those two because they are 4x4 matrices, right? But they're related to them in a very simple way. So gamma mu is a Dirac matrix, is equal to 0 sigma mu sigma bar mu 0. Okay, that's called the Weyl representation. This is in the Weyl representation of the Dirac matrices. Now, it's not the only kind of representation. You can go to a different basis where this is not the way you write the Dirac matrices. There is what's called the Dirac basis, which is more useful for non-relativistic computations. But that's one way of defining the gamma matrices, right? Now, remember that the real definition of these sort of matrices is through their algebra, through the algebras they form. Right, and the algebras they form is that the anticommutator of two gamma matrices is equal to 2 times the metric. Right, you have all seen this. So the Pauli matrices obey a very similar relationship, except that it's between sigma and sigma bar. All right, and the way to remember it is that I've shown you what sigmas look like, but I haven't discussed what are those indices here? Where do they sit? The alpha bar, the alpha dot, and the alpha. And the way they sit, they remind us that those are in fact matrices and they carry their own index, right? Because they're a 2x2 component. How do I refer to the 1x1 component of sigma 1? Right? It's because I have little indices here that for the sigma, they sit as alpha, alpha dot. And so the 1-1 component, for example, is alpha equal to 1, alpha dot equal to 1. Okay? The sigma bar has a slightly different index. It's sitting on top, and it starts with the alpha dot and then alpha. Now, why do we need all this silliness? It's because this way of writing it, if you remember that the indices are downwards for the sigma and start with alpha, not with the dot, and the indices are upwards for the bar, then it's very, very easy to construct relativistically invariant structures. Because all you have to make sure is that every alpha that you have on the top gets contracted with an alpha at the bottom. And every alpha dot that you have in the bottom gets contracted with an alpha dot at the top. So for example, if I have sigma mu alpha alpha dot, why do I need to multiply this to make a relativistic invariant? What kind of object do you have to make this a relativistic invariant? If you have sigma bar alpha dot alpha, then one way you can do it is you can contract it with alpha dot, and let's put a beta, and then a mu. And that will be a structure that you contracted the alpha dots, you contracted the mu's, but you haven't contracted those guys, so just make this one into an alpha. And that's it. That's a relativistic invariant. So now that shows us why this is a relativistic invariant, right? Because this field comes with an alpha, this field comes with an alpha dot. And so by putting a sigma bar, I absorbed the alpha dot and I absorbed the alpha. Okay. Now you can wonder, why did I not use sigma? Why do I use sigma bar? Yeah.
So what would that matrix be? Because it cannot be the identity matrix. Would the identity
Why can it not?
Because it's the identity matrix, because it's part of a 4 vector. So would that be considered
So if this was here, yeah, then this would just be proportional to the metric. right? And so by raising this index upwards, I just create the identity. That's a good question, yeah. All right? So if you use this relation now, the right relation is sigma mu sigma bar nu is equal to 2 eta mu nu. But what about those indices? How do those indices contract? Well, you have alpha and an alpha dot on this guy because they're lower, and then an alpha dot here and a beta. And so really there should also be a delta alpha beta that tells you that this is a 2 by 2 matrix. Remember that those matrices, those indices mu and nu have to do with space-time, right? With which of the Pauli matrices you're talking about. Those indices, the alpha and alpha dot, have to do with which component in the matrix you are discussing. Are you discussing this component or this component or this component? Okay. The mu and nu are telling you which of the Paulis. Are you talking about sigma 3, sigma 1, or sigma naught? Okay. So it might take you a little bit of time to get used to it, but you don't won't really need it for the rest of this course. It's just giving you a rationale for why you're contracting it the way you do. Okay, yeah.
So do the Bauer fermions furnish a representation of the Lorentz group?
That's right. So the Weyl fermions are actually an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group, unlike Dirac fermions, which are a reducible representation. Now, the difference between a reducible and an irreducible representation is that a reducible can be written as a sum of some other two or three or more irreducible representation, right? And you can think about irreducible representation as sort of like the basis vector that make up a linear space, right? It's not exactly the same, but roughly the basic components that make up any other representation. And you see now why. The reason why the Dirac matrices or Dirac fermions are a reducible representation is because they are written in terms of two other, the sigma and sigma bar representation, which are irreducible. Okay, so it can be split into two kind of representations. All right, so that's why the Dirac representation is in fact a reducible representation of the Lorentz group. Yeah.
And how do we raise or lower the
The spinor index. So good. So you raise and lower the spinor index with basically sigma 2. Usually it's given a special symbol epsilon, which is essentially I times sigma 2, and it's this sort of a matrix. Okay, and it carries, depending on which way you want to raise it, it either carries alpha alpha dot, or it carries, alpha alpha dot, or it carries alpha dot alpha. Okay, and so by just multiplying this matrix, you can raise or lower the indices. Okay, and we'll see it in a moment. All right, so it's been a long and winding road to write a kinetic term. But you need it if you actually want to talk about things which are less trivial than just scalars. But is this part clear? Yeah? So if you're confused about Dirac or versus Weyl, just come talk to me after lecture. We can clarify it. But at some level, it's just getting used to talking about more than just scalars. All right, so this is the kinetic terms, but of course the world will be a very boring place if that's the only thing you have, because we need interactions. So what are the kind of interactions you can imagine? Well, before we do interactions, unfortunately I weigh something, maybe fortunately, maybe unfortunately, maybe too much. I weigh something, right? So what kind of things we might be missing here? Where does my weight appear? What kind of things we have not written for those fields yet? Mass terms, right? So how do you write a mass term for the scalar? You can simply write m phi dagger phi, right? And again, remember, I'm neglecting all the dependency on the space-time, but you should remember always that when I talk about phi, it's some space-time field, right? So this is how you write a mass term for phi. Okay, now why not phi square? Why do I need to include phi star? Maybe I don't. So in general, I don't. I could write phi square. I don't have to write phi star phi. The reason why I want to write phi star phi is because I want this theory to have certain symmetries that we'll discuss later on. But you agree that phi star phi is invariant under certain rotations that phi square alone is not. So, right? So let's consider those two terms. So the two alternatives are, let's write it here. I could have written phi star phi, or I couldn't have written phi phi. Now, what kind of thing I can do to this field that I cannot do to this ones? What kind of operation I can do is that relieve it invariant? Phase rotation, right? So suppose I send phi to e to the I theta of phi, and that means that phi star goes to e to the minus I theta of phi star, right? So that shows me that this part goes to just itself, right? Because the I theta here cancels against the minus I theta from the phi star. Whereas this term will go to e to the 2i theta phi phi. So it's not invariant. It actually gets a phase, right? So this term has a higher symmetry than this one. And that's why I will keep it, right? I don't have to. There are theories, perfectly reasonable theories, where I actually have phi phi or phi star, but for our purposes, we'll keep that extra symmetry, yeah. It's not so much the complex Lagrangian. You don't want complex Lagrangians, but the Lagrangian doesn't have to respect this rotation, right? I could write my mass term as m square phi square plus the Hermitian conjugate, right? The Hermitian conjugate is just phi star. That would be a perfectly real Lagrangian, but it won't obey that symmetry. Okay, that's a great question. Whenever I do, you have to make sure that at the end of the day is that the Lagrangian is real, right? So add whatever Hermitian conjugates you need to add. Okay, so we have mass terms. I could also write a mass term for the fermion. Let me do it now, but we won't quite use it until later on, but let me just do it. So how would you write a mass term for the fermion? What kind of objects you will try to play with? Think about it as just Lego. You have a bunch of objects. You have psi, phi, psi dagger. What kind of objects you will need to create a mass term for the fermion? No? It's not a trick question. What kind of objects you could possibly use to create a mass term for the fermion?
Psi bar.
Psi bar, right? So you want psi, maybe you want psi bar. Turns out that we can just use one term will be, I'll write as a half m psi psi. And then I'll have another term which is a half m psi dagger. Okay? Well, where are my space-time indices? I should write those annoying alpha dots, right? Well, here they are. So this one comes like that, psi alpha, and this one I have alpha dot. If you're worried, why does the alpha appear here upwards and here it appears downwards? Don't worry about it. It's a matter of conventions. It's a question of where you put your minus signs. It's not going to matter for anything we will do. But if you care much about it, I can give you some references to do that. But why did we do that? We did it exactly because of this question of how do you lower and raise indices. We used those structures because really what it was, it used to be psi alpha psi beta, right? That's how I just take a bilinear of the terms. But this is not relativistically invariant. I need to contract them. And so the way I contract them is that I add a term which is psi alpha beta. Okay, and that effectively lowers one of those indices and make it into a relativistic invariant. So whenever you take two fermions, whenever you take those two Weyl fermions, the thing that you start with is something that has indices that are just floating. And you need to contract them somehow to get a relativistic invariant. Yeah?
So in that black hole, the epsilon should be alpha, beta, and...
Oh, it doesn't matter. You call it alpha, beta, or alpha. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah, there should only be a... Thank you. There should only be either dotted or undotted. That's right. Thank you. Okay? So this is how we write mass terms for those Weyl fermions. And in a couple of lectures, maybe I'll show you how you can use that to write Dirac-like mass matrices, which is probably what you have seen. But for now, this will suffice. Okay, so... That's nice, but this is still a very boring theory because there is nothing happening, right? Those are just free particles. So what kind of structures you can write to make life interesting? Again, think about it as Lego. You have a bunch of pieces. What kind of pieces you need to create, make life interesting? How many of you played with Lego when you were kids? I used to love Lego. And so you can create that. You just take pieces and you make it into make life interesting. So tell me, what Lego parts you use? What kind of terms you can possibly write to make life a little more interesting? Huh? Yokawa, right? So what does Yokawa consist of? One scalar, two fermions. Perfect. So I can write, I have the scalar phi, right? And I have two Weyl fermions, psi alpha and psi beta, right? And I'll write a half y in front. So let's not worry about the half y in for a moment. The half is there just to make life easier later on. It's just a matter of convention. It's for the same reason you have a half here. Y is just some coupling constant, right? It's telling us how strong this interaction is. But I'm not done, right? What is the problem with phi psi alpha psi beta? What does it violate? I need to contract them, right? This is not relativistically invariant. Remember, whenever you have floating space-time indices, you're doing something wrong. Just like in undergraduate, if you've ever done four vectors in undergraduate, remember whoever was your lecturer always told you, you cannot have floating indices going around because that means that object is not relativistically invariant. You need to contract it with the metric. You need to make sure that you have as many up or up as down indices. Very similarly, that is true for those spinorial indices. You need to make sure that all the spinorial indices are contracted in Lagrangian, otherwise it's not relativistically invariant. So what am I missing? Yeah, exactly. Epsilon alpha beta. Right? So in effect, what this does, this epsilon alpha beta just takes this beta, lowers it, and then I can write psi alpha up psi alpha. Okay? Oh, no. It ran away. Okay. I know, yeah. Now the question is, how do I return it? So this one is, yeah. Okay. So, but as was remarked here, the Lagrangian has to be real, and so you need to add some, complex conjugate, and it's something like y star, phi star, psi dagger alpha dot, psi dagger beta dot, epsilon alpha dot beta dot, right? Okay, so that completes the Okawa interactions. Is there anything else you can write? Is there any other kind of interactions you can write? Huh? Five to the fourth, right? So I can also write an interaction which is phi star, and then just square it. And I'll add in front of it a quarter lambda. Again, the quarter is to make life simpler in other parts of the calculations. Lambda just tells you how strong that interaction is. And phi star square is the type of interaction. It's describing four fields coming at one space-time point. All right, so remember that the meaning of those interactions, the meaning of this interaction, for example, the Okawa. Okay, we won't need this anymore, so it's okay. So the meaning of the phi psi psi is that you have a space-time point where a scalar field comes in and interacts with two fermions. The meaning of phi to the fourth is that you have some space-time point where four scalars come in and interact with each other. Okay. Now again, why did I not write phi to the fourth? Why did I write phi star square? It's because I want to maintain this symmetry. I want my theory to still be symmetric under this phase rotation, right? And this term does it. Okay? Now, are there any other kind of terms you can think of? Yeah. Psi of the fourth, that's right. So psi of the fourth is another term that in principle you can write down. And there are some theories which actually have it. The reason why you want to write it here is because those sort of terms become irrelevant at low energies. So if we are very close to where the theory is defined, very close to the high energy scale lambdas that we had, then we might have to consider all those operators. But one thing that we can show in field theory is that these type of operators, which are known as non-renormalizable or irrelevant operators, actually become irrelevant, as their name implies, at low energies. So those interactions that I wrote down will be much more important than the kind of interactions that is psi to the fourth. But there are many theories that this psi to the fourth is actually very interesting. In fact, I think Natalia will mention some of those examples in next lectures. Yeah.
So sometimes we were told that a wild fermion cannot have a mass.
That's right. So that's why I said that when it has a mass, it's usually called Majorana, not vial. Yeah, so by vial fermion, I just mean that it's a 1/2 vector, so it's not a 4 component, it's a 2 component. But you're right, that normally when people talk about vial fermions, they mean a massless 2 component fermion. Yeah.
So you're using the vial notation?
I'm using the vial notation. I mean, I'm using a 2 component spinor. That's right. Okay, so now, as I said, in field theory, this theory is defined only up to, this theory is defined with respect to some cutoff, right? With respect to some high energy scale at which this is no longer the right description. And in the next little while, we're going to do some computations. In those computations, we'll find out that there are some divergences. And we need to understand what is the meaning of those divergences. But in order to do so, we need to understand better what are those terms, what is the meaning of those terms that we have written down in the Lagrangian. Okay? And before I do so, let me just remark that we may or may not get to that, but there are actually other terms you can write down in this Lagrangian that we haven't written down. And we'll do it maybe a little later. But for our purposes, this will suffice. Okay? All righty. Now, does this Lagrangian really obey this symmetry into the R-phi? So I'll leave it to you as a homework to think about whether these Lagrangians that I've written down, at the end of the day, whether this Lagrangian really obeys this symmetry or not. Okay? And think about in particular about the Yokawa terms. All right, so What we want to do in the next little while is to actually compute some physical processes to understand how does this Lagrangian, what kind of processes it describes. So what are the kind of processes we might hope to describe? We can describe things like scalar colliding with each other and annihilating into two fermions. Right, that's one kind of process we can use. By the way, if you're concerned, why are we talking about scalars, fermions, phi? What does that have anything to do with the real world? For example, pions and protons are described like that, right? Pions are scalars, protons are fermions. It's not exactly right because protons are Dirac fermions, not Weyl fermions, and pions are charged, not neutral. But This is a warm-up to actually doing pion-proton scattering, right? So this, for example, this process describes pion-pion annihilation into two protons or two neutrons. Yeah?
Okay, so for the Yukawatan, why did we not consider a psi and a psi star in one?
To write phi psi psi star. Because that's not relativistically invariant, right? Because so let's write it. You take your Lego, you have psi, and then the next Lego component is psi. The last one is, as you said, psi dagger. But what kind of index does it come with? It comes with a beta dot, right? It has to have a dot. So let's put it here. It doesn't really matter. I can put it up or down. Doesn't really matter. But now, how do you contract alpha and beta dot? The mass terms have epsilon alpha beta. There's no dot.
I'm saying if you write it in the same way as the
mass term or kinetic term? So let's write the kinetic term. So sigma, so let's put the beta up. So sigma alpha beta dot, right? That's what you want. But remember, sigma comes with a space-time index mu. Right? So now what contracts mu? Put a derivative. That's okay, but that's no longer a Yukawa term. Okay, so this is exactly, that's a great question. And this is exactly why this notation is so useful, because you can just follow the logic. You just start writing them down, and you look at it and say, I have alpha and beta dot. The only structures that have both indices is sigmas. I have both alpha and beta dots. I just said, great, let's use it. So we used it. But then we ran into the problem that this structure comes with another index, that in the kinetic term, that index was contracted against the derivative. So I can do the same thing, put a derivative. And that's a perfectly legitimate term, and that's a fine term that you can consider, but it suffers from the same problems that I mentioned before, that this is a higher dimensional operator. This operator becomes irrelevant at low energies. And that's why we're not considering it. Yeah?
But you can add some sort of charge conjugation?
So if you're thinking about charge conjugation in the form of Dirac fermions, you don't have those structures here. The only structures you have, and this is why it's so much simpler to talk about, because there are very few things you can consider. The only structures you have for Weyl fermions is the epsilon tensor that has terms that has indices alpha and beta, where you can contract undotted or dotted indices, or the sigma matrices, which are alpha beta. But they come with an additional index mu. And those are the only objects, aside from the field themselves, that you can use to contract. And that's why it's so powerful, because you have very limited options. There aren't too many ways in which you can contract things. Okay? So you're right. We could have considered this term, and written this way, it is legitimate, relativistically invariant, but it's a higher dimensional operator. Okay. All right. So this is one process. What is another kind of process we can consider? What do protons do sometimes when you throw them at each other? Protons scatter, right? If you send one proton against another, they scatter, And they scatter because they exchange some force. Right? So another kind of force we can consider is fermion-fermion scattering. Right? Now, I need to start being a little careful, and so I could start putting lines, because this is a complex scalar, I can start putting lines on the different fields, and the lines will look something like that. Okay? So these are the kind of processes we would like to look at, but this is not enough. This will be enough if you do classical field theory. You can just write those things down, calculate them, put the lambda and whatever, and it'll be done. But this is quantum field theory. And those processes get correction from quantum effects. So if I really wanted to calculate something like that, if I really wanted to know what is the physical answer for this sort of annihilation, this is not the only diagram that I'll have to consider. Well, there is a more general way of saying it, but let's just say it in this form for a moment. The other kind of diagram that you need to consider are things that, for example, where you have a bubble in the fermion in between. So this is a one loop correction. Right? Where the fermions that you exchange gets a correction from a fermion and a scalar virtual particles. Right? Another kind of corrections you'll need to consider is a correction to the vertex. Right? That's a correction to the strength of the interaction. Another kind of correction you have to consider is this. Right? And on and on and on and on. And not only one loop, you'll have to consider two loops and three loops. Right? And if you really want to consider, if you really want to calculate the entire effect, you'll have to consider this to all orders. And this will be a problem. And in general, we don't know how to do that. So what saves us? Not always, but what is one thing that, for example, how is this diagram different from this one? Coupling constants, right? Let's count coupling constants. So where are the couplings here? I have one here, and I have one here. Right? So this diagram is proportional to what? What is this diagram proportional to?
Y-square.
Y-square, right? So this diagram goes like y-square. What about this diagram? What is it proportional to? I have a coupling constant here. I have a coupling constant here. I have a coupling constant here. And I have a coupling constant here. So what will this diagram be proportional to? Y to the fourth, right? And similarly, you can show yourself, you can convince yourself that all the other diagrams will go with higher powers of the coupling, either Y or lambda. Okay? So there may be a way out. It may be that this, if this coupling constant y is small there is some notion of smallness, then maybe those diagrams, while present, are in fact less significant than this first order effect, and the higher loops, like two loop or three loops, are even less significant than this one. Okay, there is a hope that maybe that is true, but of course, you should be very skeptical towards those sort of ideas. Because just because I have this y, okay, that's fine, but what if it multiplies infinity? Right? What if somehow this loop is actually some huge number that multiplies y? Then yes, y is small, and indeed y squared is much bigger than y to the fourth, but this whole diagram is multiplied by some huge number. So it is not true that those diagrams are small compared to this one. And then perturbation theory breaks down. There is no way you can say that in any way those diagrams are insignificant compared to the first one, right? And this is what we're going to try to do in the next couple of lectures, to understand in what way we can actually do this computation in a reliable way, and how do we extract physical answers from them. Okay, and we'll see that we won't do it, of course, the entire program, but we'll see that a lot of it boils down to computing some very simple diagrams, like the correction to the fermion propagator from the virtual particles. But I want to emphasize to you that in general, there is no way to compute it. We don't know of a general way of computing it except for putting it on computers, defining the quantum field theory in a computer, and that's how we know to compute general diagrams. Because really, what this process is not this silly plot that I've shown here. Really, what this process is, in its full generality, is a scalar coming in, something is happening, and a fermion and an antifermion coming out. This is really the process. And quantum mechanics does whatever it likes in between, and we don't know how to compute that. We can write the quantum field theories that describe that, because we think that that's what describes the states far away. As I go to infinity, to the past, this is minus infinity, this is plus infinity. I know that far away, those fields are described by this Lagrangian, but in between, I have no idea how to describe that. And in general, I need to account for all those contributions, and they may be large. The reason why we managed to make progress in the last 50 years or so, and the reason why we believe that quantum field theory is the right description of nature to the length scales that we can probe, is because many of the fields we know actually have small couplings like that, like y and lambda, where we can do reliable calculations like this and get trustworthy answers. If that wasn't the case, we would be screwed. And this was indeed what happened in the 50s and 60s, where they start seeing pions and protons, and the only thing that is not right about this description of pions and protons is that from pions and protons, this coupling is huge. This y and lambda are very large. So for those sort of processes, you indeed cannot use perturbation theory. And quantum field theory for these sort of processes is fairly useless. The remarkable thing is that protons and pions and neutrons and kaons and all those particles turn out to be described by more fundamental constituents called quarks. And when you start talking about quarks at those energy scales, when you start talking about quark-quark collisions and quarks with gluons collision and all those things, then it turns out that in those energy scales, all of a sudden, there is a small coupling again. There is some notion of perturbation theory being a good description, and we can do calculations there, and we'll do such calculations, hopefully, sometime in this lecture. But if it wasn't for that, this is pretty useless. We really need this idea of a small coupling to be able to do those calculations. All right? Okay, so what I want to do in the next... We're pretty much done. But let's just, in the next 5 minutes, set up the kind of calculations that we want to do in the next class. Okay, so we have the Lagrangian, we have the theories that we care for, and we sort of have an idea for what kind of processes we would like to look at. But let's start by writing down what is the kind of things that we want to calculate in the next class. Okay, so we said that, you know, there are many kind of corrections. We're not going to calculate all those different diagrams, but you see, just like Lego, that they're made up of some basic corrections that maybe are easier to start with. So for example, let me do this. So the easiest correction to start with is a correction to the two-point function, to what happens to a field as it goes through space by itself, right? So we know that the first order correction is just coming from the Lagrangian itself. It is something that looks like the propagator, right? This is how we describe the propagator for a single scalar. Phi comes in, phi comes out. Right? This is how we describe this sort of propagator. It's the inverse of the quadratic term in the Lagrangian. Have any of you seen this before? You have seen what? Okay. There is a very simple way to derive it by just taking the inverse. Now, what we want to understand is, what is the first order correction? How can I correct this propagator? What kind of quantum mechanical process I can have? Well, one of them is just using the Yokawa term. I have an interaction point where four scalar fields meet, right? This is how it looks like if I didn't contract it. Just I have 1, 2, 3, 4, and I can just combine two of them together. And this is a correction to the scalar propagator. And I need to know how to compute this. Right? What is another kind of correction I can have? This is order lambda. What is another kind of correction to the scalar propagator that you can have? So I can have fermion loop, right? Fermion coming in, scalar coming out. And this is just the Yokawa, and this is proportional to y square. Right? So this is, and this is in fact, that's it. These are all the corrections at one loop for the scalar. Okay? What about the fermion? The fermion looks something like that. By the way, for the rest of tomorrow and all that, I'm going to ignore the mass term for the fermion. Okay, it complicates things for no good reason. Let's just ignore it. Okay, so we'll from now on we'll just imagine the fermion is massless. So it's a real Weyl fermion. So then this thing is just I sigma bar sigma mu divided by p square minus zero. So just plus I epsilon, and p here is the momentum that flows. Okay, and very similarly to the mass to the scalar, I have a correction to it that looks like this. Okay, it's proportional also to y square. So that's what we'll do next time. We'll try to see how we can actually compute those diagrams and what do they tell us about this theory. Okay, we'll do it a little more systematically and understand exactly how to interpret what we find. All right? Yeah.
So do we have a p in the numerator?
Ah, thank you. Sorry. Very good. Yeah. Of course. Thank you. Okay? That's it. Free people.